This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today, we're going to remember Neil Conan, who played an important part in the history of NPR on and off the air. He died Tuesday of glioblastoma, an aggressive type of brain cancer. He was 71. He worked at NPR for 36 years in several capacities as a reporter, executive producer of All Things Considered, news director, London bureau chief, and anchoring live coverage of hearings and events. In 1991, while reporting on the Gulf War, he was captured by the Iraqi Republican Guard and held hostage for 1 week. For 13 years, he was a daily presence in the lives of many listeners as the host of NPR's talk show Talk of the Nation. We were lucky to have Neil as a guest host on Fresh Air for a week in April 2001. Of course, he sounded great.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, an anatomy of the National Security Agency. The CIA gets most of the publicity, but the NSA is the bigger, more powerful, and more secretive. Where else would you find the job title Chief of Anonymity? We'll talk with James Bamford about his new book.
It was a little frustrating for me, knowing Neil was in Philly, working on our show, but I wasn't going to get a chance to work with him because I was on vacation. We're going to listen back to the interview I recorded with him in 2002, after he'd written a book about a surprising break he took from NPR one summer to do this.
There's a fly ball down the left field line. Lofton is running. I think he'll have room for this one. No, he will not! That's a solo home run, and the Arsenal have gone back to back!
During the summer of 2000, Neil did play-by-play radio announcing for the Aberdeen Arsenal, a minor league baseball team in the Atlantic League. It was the team's first and only season. Neil made an even more dramatic and long-term change in his life after Talk of the Nation ended its run in 2013. He moved to Hawaii, became a macadamia nut farmer, and hosted a show on Hawaii Public Radio. I spoke with Neil Conan in 2002. After the publication of his memoir, Play by Play, Baseball, Radio, and Life in the Last Chance League, we started with a short reading from his memoir.
I was no longer 50. I was going on 51. My daughter and her boyfriend drove a Ryder truck up from college to move her stuff to Florida. I have a wonderful job as a radio news correspondent and host that's allowed me to go to all kinds of places and do interesting things, but I was bored, probably with myself. Call it burnout or midlife crisis, but after Whitewater, Newt, Monica, and impeachment, I was weary. With bleak months of what promised to be a joyless presidential election campaign stretching ahead, I thought it miraculous when Keith Lupton called with a chance to broadcast baseball instead. This was fate. I cashed in 23 years of tenure at National Public Radio and abandoned wife, children, yard, cat, and a career inside the Washington Beltway to punch my ticket to the small time. This summer, my audience would be measured in dozens, not millions. Accustomed to broadcasting with the help of two technicians, a producer, and a director in a state-of-the-art studio, I would be a one-man traveling band. I called up the team's schedule on my computer. In late July, I could anchor three nights of the Republican National Convention live from the First Union Center in Philadelphia or call play-by-play of a three-game set against the Bluefish at Harbor Yard in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Baseball sounded like a lot more fun.
No, you're right. It was good to escape to a place where we all know the rules of the game. What was comforting about that?
It was comforting. Well, one of the things about baseball is that you're the same age and you're all ages. When you walk into the ballpark, you're 8 years old and you're 14 years old and you're 23 and you're 52. Another thing about baseball that's really gratifying is, as you mentioned, the rules are the same. You know what's going on. And baseball is one of those things that truly rewards study. The more you know about it, the more interesting it gets. And that was really one of the great revelations of the summer. There was a fear that, you know, after a while you'd get bored with this too. And that didn't happen at all. And one of the things that was really critical about that whole summer, and this was the idea of, I kept talking to ballplayers about why they did it, why they took the chance to play in this Verschlugener league and at the end of the road. And a lot of, and they had many different reasons, but I one of the most compelling was the idea that they had to go out there and compete, that it was hard to do this. This was difficult to do. And I realized that one of the things that was happening to me at work and early in the season doing the play-by-play stuff was I was intimidated by something that was so difficult to do. It was very, very hard. And if I looked at that instead as a challenge, as an opportunity, the way the ball players did, you know, I really want to go up against that. He's the best pitcher in the league. If it were me, I'd be looking for a way to, you know, come down with a sore throat that day. but instead, you know, they were really looking forward to this challenge. And you know, as a ball player, as a hitter, if you succeed one time in three, you're doing great. So two times out of three, you're going to fail. And at those ratios, if they could take the rejection that involved, I sure could too. And my rejection rate wasn't anywhere near as difficult or as impossible as that. It was hard to do it. And I really began to appreciate how difficult it was and how much enjoyment I got from the fact that once you started the game, you finished the pregame show and they threw the first pitch, you just stepped off the cliff. Nobody knew what was going to happen.
Well, actually, your first night of broadcasting, you almost didn't make it on the air because you couldn't get the system to work.
Yeah, that was loads of fun. I was the one, the general manager, Keith Lupton, said, well, what kind of equipment should we buy? And you know, I came up with all of these suggestions, and some of my colleagues here at National Public Radio, in fact, gave me some advice. And so we bought all of this equipment. It's thousands of dollars of stuff with microphones and mixers and a box that connects my telephone line to the line back at the to another box back at the station, and it's supposed to transform a regular old telephone line magically into a decent quality broadcast circuit for very little money. That's kind of the whole idea of minor league baseball. But we couldn't get it to work. We couldn't get the marriage of the two machines to last more than 20 seconds. And I'm sitting there sweating bullets as we're trying to get this to work for the 100th time. So the chief engineer figured out that the only way to get on the air was to have me just make a regular phone call from the press box to the studio, put that phone call up on the speakerphone, put a microphone on the speaker from the speakerphone, and that was what was on the radio. And I just had this feeling that Guglielmo Marconi was rolling in his grave. This was probably the worst audio that had ever been broadcast on FM.
It was probably pretty unlistenable. You're probably on the air in name only.
And just as well, because I was screwing up the broadcast. In all of the confusion, I finally got in the air. It was the top of the first inning, and I, you know, announced the first batter, and he struck out. Hey, there's the first out of the season and all this sort of stuff. And the next batter hits a single into center field, and that's when I notice that there's a runner rounding third. Where did he come from?
You were actually afraid you'd be fired. At least that's what you say you were.
I was terribly afraid I was being fired.
What were some of the things that were going wrong in the early broadcasts?
Well, I didn't know any stories about, you know, this was a brand new team, and these guys all had baseball histories, but I didn't know them. And, you know, they don't have baseball cards. There's no media guide that gives you, you know, 15 pages on Danny Perez and what he does and what pitches he likes to hit and all this. I didn't have anything to talk about early in the game, and there were these long, awkward gaps. And it became progressively more difficult as you say, well, then I've got to say something important. I've got to say something clever, something good. And then, you freeze. And the other problem I would have was actually describing the action. And I would try to be doing too much at the time. You know, the ball is rolling out to the gap in left center field, and you're trying to describe the runner rounding third and about to come home, and then the left fielder chasing the ball. And I would start to get confused, and it was difficult to string together a narrative of what was actually happening until I remembered. This is one of those lessons that I learned working at National Public Radio and substituting for Bob Edwards on Morning Edition and talking with Red Barber all those years ago. And Red said there was only one thing that a play-by-play announcer really had to do, and that was follow the ball and explain what was happening with the ball. And you can back and fill later to explain what was happening with the people on the bases. And once I remembered that, it became a little bit easier.
Well, why don't we give a listen to you in the announcer's booth doing play-by-play at a very manic moment.
There's one belted into right center field. Nobody's going to catch this one. That's gone! Back to back to back! The Arsenal, for the first time in club history, have three consecutive home runs. Cepeda, Martinez, and now David Steed. And they lead the game 8-3.
Neil, how do you decide, like, how excited to get? Because there is a certain amount of theater in all of this.
Oh, sure. A lot of it's performance. You tend to get more excited about your team's home runs than the other team's home runs, for sure. And that was a terrific moment for the ball club and against a particularly hated rival, the Nashua Pride, who drubbed us in their ballpark, it seemed, every single time, and came back eventually and made that one a nail-biter before it was over. One of the things that a lot of people ask me about, you know, is did I have a home run call? And, well, you just heard one. And I tried not to develop the, you know, that sort of cookie-cutter, one-size-fits-all home run call, you know, the see ya or there it goes, Papa, or one of those, you know, the trademark home run call, because, you know, each one, it seemed, deserved its own description. But you find out baseball is a game where a lot of things repeat themselves. Situations repeat themselves and kinds of hits repeat themselves, and there are certain kinds of home runs. And yeah, you do develop certain patterns and degrees of excitement, but you're trying to bring the audience along with you, and that was a tremendous moment. Frank Zappa, the famous rock musician and composer, once said, loud and soft, that's showmanship. And it's true in play-by-play, I suspect, just as much as it is in music.
Now, in listening to a little bit of your play-by-play, I noticed there wasn't a lot of fan noise behind you, some of the play-by-play. Is that because of the way you were mic'd or because of the lack of fans?
That was because it was an Arsenal home run in the visiting ballpark. There were, in fact, a fair number of fans that day in Nashua, but they wouldn't be cheering the opposition's home run. And it was sort of odd that I had to pick out, when I was pulling tape clips, to find any crowd sound at all. I had to get all the stuff on the road. There wasn't any sound at all from the crowd at Arsenal games, because there wasn't much of a crowd at Arsenal games. There was one doubleheader that we had started the second game. There'd been rain problems, and we started the second game at 10 o'clock at night, rather late, during a weeknight, just about anywhere to start a sporting event. And we counted 12 people in the stands, and all of them were in some way related to somebody either working at the ballpark or on one of the teams.
Wow. When you're in your capacity as reporter or host, mm-hmm. for NPR, you have to be, a fair and objective and distanced and all of that. When you're announcing baseball, you're supposed to be really engaged, mm-hmm. and enthusiastic when your team wins and really manic when there's a home run. Can you talk a little bit about the different voices that you've used on NPR as a reporter or host compared to the voice of Neil Conan, baseball play-by-play announcer?
In my job as host of Talk of the Nation, it's clearly my job to be objective, to not take sides. When you're announcing for a baseball team, for the local team, you work for the team, and you are expected to take sides. And that's not to say that you're going to, you know, dump on the opposition and say that everything they do is terrible. You have to appreciate the opposition. In fact, one of the things you need to do, if your team's going to be any good at all, if your champions are great ball players, well, they have to be playing against great champions. It's not Ali without Frazier, if you understand what I'm meaning. So the other team have to be respectable. But yes, we're on our side. And after a lifetime of being on the sidelines as an observer of all of this, it was so refreshing and so nice to actually be able to take sides and feel good about it. It was the right thing to do. It was our team.
And how did play-by-play change your voice?
Oh, that was interesting, too. Noah Adams, our colleague, had always talked about finding your note as a broadcaster, the spot in your chest and your throat where your voice sounds nice and comfortable, and you get that resonance that we're all looking for, whenever we can. Now, I've been in radio a long time, Terry, and I thought that I found my note long ago. But I found up on the roof at the trailer where we broadcast our games at Thomas Run Park that I found that I hadn't found my voice. It was another spot, a little bit lower in my throat and a little bit lower in my chest, that was much more comfortable for me to work in and I think much more comfortable for listeners to hear. And I wondered after a while whether it wasn't just a different, whether I'd found the note that had been eluding me all of those years, or whether it was just, you know, working every day on the radio so much, whether I just broke it in properly for the first time.
What's the difference in the sound, do you think?
It's a little bit lower. It's a little bit slower. I think it's a little bit more self-assured, and that you could only succeed at, again, it was like baseball itself, you know, something that's incredibly challenging, but you only succeed when you relax. If you're tense, if you're worried about it, you're not going to be able to do it well. And finally, on the roof of that trailer, I was able to relax into it, and I didn't worry about it. It was an extraordinary feeling of command. I'm not sure that I've ever been in a situation quite like that as a broadcaster before, where toward the end of the year, when I knew all of the stories about all of these players and all of the visiting players as well, and I knew the league as well as anybody knew the league, that I was in command of my material, and it was just the most fun I've ever had.
What was it like after your summer of play-by-play to return to your duties at NPR?
Initially, it was difficult. I had, somewhere in the back of my mind, thought that this was going to be a break. Ann Garrels, in fact, had said, you know, something will happen and you won't come back. And it was, to some degree, was it a failure to come back? Had I not done this well enough to make a career out of it, to sidestep and move on? And in that respect, I was a little discouraged, and the other part of it is that I'd hoped to avoid what I'd feared was that joyless presidential election campaign, and got back in time to, in fact, anchor the last two presidential debates, and then, as you recall, that one went into extra innings,
and right.
Got a chance to do quite a bit of that as well, and doing play-by-play of the Florida Supreme Court, not that long after doing play-by-play of the Aberdeen Arsenal. And that part of it was fun, and what I realized was that I had learned while I was away that the thing that I really was interested in, at least now, was in live radio, that I'd really come to love thinking with the last tenth of an inch of your tongue. And that was such a challenge every day, and that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to find a place where I could be on the radio every day, and I honestly wasn't sure that National Public Radio was going to be that place. And so I started looking for other opportunities to do that, and as it happened, the opportunity to do that happened at National Public Radio.
Through Talk of the Nation.
Yeah, exactly.
One thing we didn't mention is, and you talk about this in your book, is that you were kidnapped during the Gulf War. Mm-hmm. You were held for a week. And you describe the experience in the book. And you say about it that afterwards you recognize the symptoms of adrenaline addiction. You know, when you mm-hmm. were looking back on it and every moment seems so vivid to you.
Yeah.
And you describe adrenaline addiction as the affliction that drives some reporters from one hot spot to another. Just describe your sense of this adrenaline addiction.
It didn't strike so much in the trip in which I got captured by the Republican Guard and held for a week. As dramatic as that stuff was, and it certainly was vivid, it was almost the next trip back. I went back to Iraq, this time to northern Iraq, with a producer from here, Marie Dilge, and we got a pretty good story. We got a story from various sources that the coalition had missed a lot of Iraq's nuclear weapons program, and this turned out to be, in fact, the entire part of the Iraqi weapons program that nobody had been aware of before the war happened. And that story and the context in which we developed it and all of the excitement and the danger of northern Iraq after the war, it was such a rush. It was so gratifying. It was so exciting. And again, you know, in terms of danger, there are always chances that these stories could be wrong. It didn't turn out that one was. We were right. But, you know, it's tremendously thrilling. And I got this feeling that I used to describe to people, my friends, as feeling big. And I'm not sure exactly what I meant by that, but I guess emotionally big, this feeling that I could fill the room. And this was, at the same time, tremendously, you're aware, you're focused, you're concentrated, but you're also not who you are. You're somebody else. You've transformed into this other character that's driven by things that you're normally not driven by. And those things are difficult to get those two things to work together and to bring yourself back to who you were. And that's one thing that I think having a family was more important in that respect than anything else. There's nothing that will bring you back to earth quicker than children who don't really care about what your pretensions are or how, you know, your emotional inflation is doing that day. What they care about is dad. And that was tremendously important. And I felt like I had to back off after that. That at that moment I had an opportunity, if I'd wanted to take it, to be, you know, that hotshot foreign correspondent who goes from one hotspot to another, who never gets enough danger, who lives for all of those moments, or I could go back to being who I really was. And to some degree, I decided to go back to who I was, if in no small part for the kids, if nothing else.
You write about these two emotional extremes that you went through, you know, that kind of addiction to adrenaline thing, the feeling big.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, a feeling of paralysis.
Yeah, that's
after
the
you
downside
came home
of it, yeah.
After the kidnapping. Could you describe that feeling?
Yeah, it's a little bit what I was talking about earlier. It's a little bit, yeah, it's the downside. It's the other side of the rush. It's the crash. And it's the feeling of inability to focus on what you need to do because you're afraid to do it. You become weighed down by expectations to some degree, your own as well as everybody else's, or your projection of what everybody else's expectations of you are. Things become more simple things, like making the first phone call on a story, become very difficult to do. And again, once I got into something, once it happened, once I didn't have time to think about it, I was fine. I was the same person. But thinking about it, getting off the dime, you know, getting myself started became harder and harder to do. And I think that there was this sort of unspecific anxiety. I was afraid. And I'm not sure exactly what I was afraid of. And you think about, you know, being in situations where, you know, they're dangerous and people are shooting. And yes, things can happen. But those don't often happen on the third floor of National Public Radio. And the fact is, there was nothing threatening me there. There was nothing stopping me. I could have done a lot more. I'd always had a tendency to passivity. That's always something I'd struggled with and fought to overcome. This just made it worse. And it made my resistance less. And I found, you know, constant excuse-making. Things were other people's faults and never mine. And that's what I really felt I had to break out of. There was this spiral that I was getting into. And I come from a family that's had a lot of problems with alcohol. And I was beginning to have problems with alcohol. And that worried me very, very seriously. And I, you know, was this it? Was I, you know, spiraling as to some degree I'd seen other people in my family spiral. And I baseball was my opportunity to say no to that. It just happened to be baseball. It could have been other things. But for me, it was baseball to step out of that and to take a look at myself and shake myself around a little bit and say, you know, what are you doing? Why are you doing it? And if you don't love it, why do you keep doing it?
You know, the thing about alcohol, being on the road is sometimes the worst thing for mm-hmm. somebody who is drinking a little too much.
You bet. There's a lot of the time there's not much left to do when the ball game ends at, 10:30 and you get back to the hotel at, 11:15, 11:30. And well, you're living the baseball life. You don't want to wake up the next day until noon because that's your schedule you're on. And the only thing that's open is the bar. You know, there's that, or you can go watch cable television up in your room. So, yeah, that can get a little scary, and you can see how those patterns can develop.
But you got through that one.
Did get through that one, yeah. And partly, I'd stopped drinking before I did this, and I did go to the bars, and I would have a few drinks, and sometimes more than a few drinks with, some of the guys and some of the situations. But I felt like I was back in control of it because I felt I was back in control of my life, that I was doing what I wanted, and it was not a crutch anymore. It was what it had been my whole life, an occasional amusement, something you did sometimes.
We were talking about adrenaline and the kind of rush you can get mm-hmm. from it. Do you think that doing a daily show like Talk of the Nation is very suitable to your temperament now? Because you've got the daily deadline, but it's not like a huge thing. It's not like you're getting kidnapped every day
no,
or you're covering
it's not.
A war every day. But there is the sense of this structure that you constantly have to fit yourself into and a daily set of deadlines to meet. So there's no time for paralysis.
There isn't. The daily rhythm makes it much easier. You're right about that. It's also that it, like play-by-play, is live, and you never know. I mean, we script. Baseball doesn't have a script, and we try to arrange these programs so that we have an idea of where they're going to be going in this part of the program or that part of the program. But a lot of the time, the program does not work out the way that we had planned it, and that's that's a great challenge. It's enormous fun. It's a lot. It's doing many of the same kinds of things that I did in play-by-play, at least in terms of technique. And the ability to go back and recap the scoring, a skill that I developed doing play-by-play, has turned out to be very useful in doing live radio. You have to go back and recap the news just about as frequently as you had to recap the scoring, as it turns out. It's live radio. It's the same kind of structure and the same kind of difficulty, the same kind of challenge.
Neil, I've always admired your writing on the air. Now that you've written a book, I'm interested in hearing what it was like for you to sit down and face the fact that you had to write like a couple of hundred pages, not you know, copy for a 6-minute report or copy to introduce a program. It's really daunting.
It is daunting. And the fact is that I had always seen myself as a writer. You know, that when I was in high school, that's what I wanted to grow up to be. And I grew up to be a broadcaster. And the whole idea of, I was intimidated by the idea of writing a whole book. I mean, you know, you and I write in seconds. We don't write in hundreds of pages. And this was a challenge, too. You know, if I was ever going to do it, if I was ever going to achieve that goal that I'd set for myself all those years before, this was going to be the opportunity. And if I didn't do it this time, it was going to be almost impossible. So sitting down and writing this book, one of the big differences between working in a newsroom and writing a book is that one of them is a very social experience where you're yelling at people and they're yelling at you and there's all kinds of activity going on. Working at home, quiet, staring at a blank computer screen was a very different kind of experience indeed. And one of the most humbling experiences I've ever had was, in fact, you do all the macro editing with your editor at the publishing house, but then eventually you get the book gets sent to a copy editor, and they, you know, they're looking at your spelling and your grammar. I know my spelling's bad. If I could spell, I wouldn't be in radio. But I thought that this was going to be like a Socratic dialogue with an editor. Well, I meant to be in the future pluperfect tense there. Absolutely. Instead, you know, what it came back was just one horrifying literary crime after another. You just wanted to. I surrendered. You know, with the third one, I thought I'd been a literate person until I read this.
On radio and in print, length is really important. You can't come in hundreds of pages over for the book that's going to be published. If your report has like 5 minutes on the air, you can't go over that,
right?
Et cetera. Whereas when you're, so everything has to be concise,
mm-hmm.
right? But when you're doing play by play, you have to fill these really long gaps of nothing happening. So, you know, concision isn't what you need. You need, like, amplification, constant amplification.
What you need, actually, Terry, is an accordion. You need to expand it or contract it. Because things happen very suddenly. You can start on this, you know, what you're thinking is going to be, an inning-killing anecdote while the... Well, the pitcher continually throws over to first base, and the next thing that happens is a ground ball smack to shortstop, over to second, back to first, double play. We'll see you for the next half inning. So you've got to be able to, you know, adapt all of this stuff, you know, either expand it, and you're right, that's the usual problem, or contract it, and, you know, some of them you have to say, well, we've finished that story in the next inning, but it's incredibly challenging to fill all of that airtime, particularly when you're by yourself. And again, in the minor leagues, for the most part, you're on by yourself. There's no color man, there's no producer, there's no statistician, there's no technic. You're doing all of this stuff yourself. And I would invite anybody who wanted to be on the radio was perfectly welcome to come on and join me for a couple of innings anytime they wanted, just to help me fill all the airtime. But eventually it got to be, you know, this ongoing dialogue between yourself and your audience. And you know, you don't think of your audience in terms of masses of people. And you're broadcasting for the Aberdeen Arsenal. This is a good thing. You think of your audience as individuals. People tend to listen to the radio alone, whether they're, you know, doing the dishes or at work or in their car or, you know, listening to the radio as they're walking or exercising or something like that. So you think of your audience as, you know, it's one-to-one. And if you're having this ongoing conversation with this one individual, that was the way I came to think about it.
You've been in the position very, very often through your career of having to fill time while waiting for the president to come in and deliver his address, or during the break in the hearings when you had to just keep filling an indefinite amount of time until mm-hmm. they'd decide to end the break. What are some of the differences between the kind of things you need to have at your fingertips and the kind of preparation you need to fill time in the hearings or during the presidential address compared to play-by-play?
Well, one of the differences is normally at National Public Radio, if we're waiting for the president, I have somebody to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
So I can generally say something clever like, Dan? If I'm doing play-by-play, there's nobody there for me to talk to. So I have to come up with something myself. And those sorts of challenges were quite interesting.
Well, Neil Conan, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, it's been a pleasure.
My interview with Neil Conan was recorded in 2002. He died Tuesday at the age of 71. We send our condolences to his family, friends, and colleagues.